The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So most people think of history as a chance to remember what was. Judaism is a very different perception of how history works. And I'll give you an example. I was once stuck in the army for Pesach. Okay? And, you know, it's pretty depressing to be stuck in the army. Once you know you're in, you're in. And we were doing the Seder night. Okay? And there were about, 300 guys. They brought us all to the central base so that we could all do the Seder together, right? And we were all sort of, you know, in different areas of the border. And you have to understand that you're talking about an audience which includes Jews from just about every background you can imagine. Yemenites and Polish origin and French and South American and American and English and everybody you can imagine, right? Ethiopians. And so he basically had to allow for every kind of custom that would come up. So it was a very long Seder. So at one point we're in the middle and we get to this section called Halachmanya. This is the bread of our affliction that our forefathers ate in Egypt, right? And generally, you know, you're talking about the matzah. So all of a sudden I noticed there's guys like sort of scattered around the dining room and they're doing something. Now I grew up in a traditional house, so I know the Seder. Never saw this before. They take their matzah, they put it like in this napkin, okay? And they're doing something. And I can't quite figure out what it is that they're doing. They're taking the matzah, right? And they're kind of like starting to sing this, and I'm like, okay, you know, we've gone back. And they take this napkin, they make a long thing, and then they throw it over their shoulders, and they start dancing, like, around the table. And I'm thinking, like, okay, you know, I grew up with the Seder, but this is way out to lunch, right? And then other guys are getting into this. They're all starting, I guess a lot of people knew this song. And pretty soon, like, 200 soldiers are, like, dancing around this table. And I realized that what they were doing was that instead of remembering the Exodus from Egypt, they were trying to relive it. And the truth is that the word zachor, to remember in Judaism, really means to experience. In fact, there's a mitzvah, zachor et yom ha-shabbat, remember the Sabbath day. And most people think that that just means that you be cognizant of the fact that, you know, God created the world or whatever it is you're remembering on Shabbat. But Judaism teaches that, Jewish tradition teaches that in order to fulfill whatever that mitzvah is, that zachor, that remembering, you make kiddush. You take a glass of wine, and that's my kind of remembering, right? You may take a glass of wine, and you sort of reenact on a certain level the process of creation. So the challenge in what we're about to do is not to get a taste of what was, but to get a sense of how much it's a part of what is. Okay? And I'll give you just, you know, by way of example, how much we miss this. I was once giving a lecture at Carnegie Mellon University. Okay? And there was like a cultural studies department day, and they asked four of us to show up and to share thoughts on our particular cultural backgrounds. This is in Pittsburgh. There was an African American who'd done a documentary on his roots. There was a Native American, American Indian. There was a Palestinian, actually, an Arab who was passing through on some kind of a tour. And there was me. I'm still not sure if I was the token Jew or the token Israeli. So we get to this hall. There's supposed to be about 50 students, and they were going to let us each present for like 5 or 10 minutes and then divide them up into their, you know, cultural, whatever groups they were going to do. 300 students showed up, 400 students showed up, you know, they had to move it to a different hall. People are looking to explore their roots. And the first guy that gets up is this Native American, okay? And stereotypes are not a good thing, but if you have a stereotype of what an Indian is, this guy was it. He was like 6'3", 6'4". I don't know what that is in meters, but he was tall. He was bronzed, like, you know, reddish. He had even braided his hair, I think, for effect. He gets up. Did you guys ever see, like, The Lone Ranger, Tonto? You know what I'm talking about? This guy looked like Tonto. He could have played Tonto in the movie, right? And Jim Thorpe. And he gets up there with his braids, and he starts to talk. And he says, you know, my name is Jim, but my real name is, Nagaawe-Noane, which means he who runs in the river and catches flies for breakfast, or whatever it is, right? And he starts telling his story. Says he was a direct descendant of Chief Sitting Bull. He had an ancestor at the Battle of the Little Bighorn that fought General Custer. how his ancestors hundreds of years earlier went for test of manhood in the mountains and learned to spear the fish in the river and hunt the buffalo on the plains. And you know, at one point he's like talking and he takes out two sticks, and while he's talking he starts to make a fire with two sticks, like on the lectern, you know, they're getting nervous in the audience. And it's just amazing. And I was sitting on the desk, like, this is awesome. I'm sitting with the guy, it's taking me back hundreds of years, giving me a chance to appreciate American, Indian, Native American culture, right? And then I'm looking around the audience, and I see there were a lot of students there, and I used to teach a class once a week at Pitt University, and I used to call them my cheeseburger class, because I always tried to use examples that wouldn't offend anybody, and they asked me to teach about mitzvot, and we got to discussing kashrut, so I said, well, like, as an example, let's say you go into a store, you get a cheeseburger, and imagine you take this cheeseburger, and I'm talking about the cheeseburger, and at one point one of the students is like, and I realize, he's eating a cheeseburger. And I'm looking at these students, these Jewish students, and I recognize some of them, and I realize that they're just as much on the edge of their seat as I am. And they're having just as good a time. And that's when it hit me. You know, and then it was my turn. And I get up and I'm thinking, okay, should I, shouldn't I, should I say, what the heck? So I said, well, my name is Bini, but my real name is Binyamin ben Pinchas. And I'm a direct descendant of Abraham, who begat Isaac, who begat, you know, he threw in a begat, and you're in, right? You know, who begat Jacob. And my ancestors crossed, you know, from Mesopotamia over the Jordan River into ancient Canaan land, right? And I'm looking at the audience, okay, and these Jewish students, they're doing exactly what you're doing. They're like, yeah, but you come up with the Abraham, right? You know? But it's true. Like, we come from 4,000 years of history. And we're going to take a walk back thousands of years. And what fascinates me the most, just by way of the end of this introduction, is not the details of the historical piece. I'm honestly less interested. I'm not a professional tour guide. I'm just a teacher who thinks that a tour is a classroom, right? And I'm less interested in whether, you know, Mameluke arches, you know, or the old city walls were built in 1538 or 1569. What fascinates me are the stories. You know, who were the people who walked these halls? And why did they come here? And what are they doing here? And what are they doing to me? So that's a little bit of food for thought, okay? We're going to go take a walk. We'll make a few pit stops on the way. We're not going to rush this. If you have questions while we're walking, feel free. All right? And there's a lot to see. We're not walking far. I could spend hours and hours and hours and hours just walking around the 500-yard radius around where we're sitting. But it does get chilly when you're standing outside, so I highly recommend you bring a coat. Come. I'm just going to get my coat. No, we can go out the front. It's easier. Right there. Hang on a sec. All right. Come over here. Hang on. Yeah, this kind of courtyard is actually called a chush. And this is how they used to build. They used to build houses that were around the courtyard. There were all sorts of discussions in the Talmud about this. You know, I was talking to you at one point about the fact that we spend so much time getting through life, so busy trying to get there, that we sometimes don't realize where we already are. And this courtyard is a perfect example of that. Okay, right now it's locked because whatever, they had some trouble, but kids who were squatting. But basically you can walk through here and go straight down to the kotel, through that gate over there. So I see people going through here, and they're so busy looking to where they're going, they don't appreciate what they already are. Right? So you look around this courtyard. I mean, I'll give you an example. Look at this. Okay, here, come step out of the way. Look at this. Okay, right? See this? Okay? This is a pillar, okay, which is 1,800 years old. Right? This was built by Jewish slaves under the Roman legionnaires' whips, right, to build a temple to Jupiter round about after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, 140, 150 of the Common Era. Okay? When you think about it, if you could go back in a time machine and tell your ancestor who worked on this column, and by the way, when I say your ancestor, so I got to be clear, you know, we walk around and our ancestors walk these paths. I want you to understand what I mean when I say that. You know, I'll give you a statistical analogy, which is statistically incorrect, but I'm the tour guide, so I can give it to you anyway. Imagine that every couple that got married, every Jewish couple, let's say, that got married, had 5 children. Now, I know that that's not true, but imagine that every Jewish couple that got married had 5 children. It's probably true around this neighborhood, okay? Fine. So, a couple gets married, and after one generation, they have, Shalom Aleichem, you've arrived.
We have my grandma.
Okay, cool, right? So, after one generation, the couple becomes 5 children. And then after a second generation, they become 25 children, right? And then 125, and then 625, and rounded off to 3,000, 15,000, 75,000, 375,000, 1.2 million, 6 million. In 10 generations. Now, most people have their children by the time they're 40 years old. So that means 400 years. Now, that's statistically incorrect, because first of all, not everybody has 5 children. And people also marry their distant cousins in the gene pool, right? So you don't find, add a generation. So that's 30 million. Add another generation, that's 150 million, right? And if a generation is 40 years, now imagine how many children the Jewish slave, if he was married, who worked in this pillar, had to have. The statistical possibility, if you had a family tree that caught all your relatives, that this slave is not part of your direct family tree, father to daughter to father to son, whatever, is so remote as to almost be infinitesimal. So this is your ancestor. Do you understand that? Like, that goes back to the oneness we were talking about this morning. If you could go back 2,000 years and whisper in the ears of this slave who's working in this column, that 1,800 years later, Jews in a modern state of Israel would be looking at his handiwork, right? And there would be a state of Israel, and Rome would be gone. Rome would be a column lying in the dust. So he would say, you were mad. You know, and here we are. And that is Jewish history in a nutshell. And by the way, if you look here, you see the intricate Roman lines? See what I'm saying? Right? It's like, so this is not real. This is like from a show. But this is very real. Okay, I've always wanted to push this over and see if it's from the 10th Legion. There would be an eagle on the other side. But that's Israel. Like, you walk around here, and, you know, there are examples even in the courtyard around. You know, you could see, like, a millstone that's, this thing over here is about 2,200 years old. They just sit in people's gardens here. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And anywhere else in the world, this would be in a museum. But in Israel, you just put it in your garden. You know, you can see another piece of a column over there, and, you know, get all excited. You find a 1,500, like on this dig yesterday where they found these 300-year-old coins. So, you know, okay, that's modern. I'm looking for something old, right? Anyway, I just showed you that so I could show you this. Come. All right? Okay. See, there's another one. Me? Hey! How's it going? L'chaim. Nice to see you. Hello! This is the first time you're here.
I've never been out of the U.S.
Wow, so you're not going to come running with us?
No, be in touch with me about that guy.
Pardon? Really? Okay, come, we're going to go for a walk. Yeah, I don't know how. I'll tell you what you'll do, though. We're going to walk into the courtyard, okay? It's good to see you. There's a ramp on the far side. I'll show you where. Come. We're walking here. There's a ramp right over there. You can walk up and follow us, okay? No problem, with pleasure. Come. We good? Okay. First of all, can you smell that? Okay, I was not born to be a vegetarian, but I imagine that that's part of the imagined pit stop, okay? When there was a temple, that's what it smelled like. I mean, they were offering sacrifices up there. That was the biggest shawarma fest in history, you know? I mean, you know, the ultimate braai for God. You know, no guilt eating, right? Anyway, Nebuch. Listen, when I got to Israelite, they were all vegetarians. I said, you want me to stay? We're going to have to go meet. So it's been a gradual process. I'm getting there, you know? So this is modern. This is like a crusader bazaar. In fact, if you look through the courtyard, you can see the crusaders came here at the end of the first crusade, second crusade, third crusade. This is where they were trying to get to. And Israelite is actually built by crusaders. That's another discussion, maybe when we're sitting back in that building. And this is part of what they built. But I'll tell you an interesting thing, just since we stopped here. So, you know, we think that we know where we are. But we really have no idea. And this is a good example, because, you know, you look around and you see what you see. But you're standing in a place that has been inhabited, basically, for 2,500 years, right? Now imagine that, you know, you got a leak in your basement and you want to fix up your basement. So everywhere else in the world, you call a plumber. And maybe you decide you want to redesign the basement, so you call an architect. And maybe you decide you don't want to do it yourself, so you call an engineer. Well, around here, you also have to call an archaeologist. There's a family that lived over here, and they wanted to expand their basement, and they started digging. And they started finding stuff. And they realized that they better call somebody. So they called the antiquities department. They got an archaeologist to come in. And they basically uncovered the lower floor, completely preserved, of a house. And they started to look at this house. And they discovered that the house was entirely burned by fire. So they carbon dated the fire. And they discovered that this was a house that had been burnt in the great fire that raged through the city when the temple was destroyed in the year 70. Okay, which is a discussion we'll have in a little while. Right? There was an unbelievable amount of destruction that occurred here. So this was the house of a family that was living here in the year 70 when the temple was destroyed. And they got burnt out. They found a Roman spearhead that was embedded in what was left of an ancient piece of wood. They think that it was the door. And therefore, they think that the Romans must have burst into the door. They found food on the table. Now, because it was an unbelievable siege, and there was tremendous famine, the fact that there was food meant that these people probably were wealthy. Most significantly, they found the seal. The seal is sort of what you stamp with letters. And the seal had the name Katros on it. Now, Katros is a name we know well. It's mentioned in the Mishnah. These were a family of priests. The Kohanim, the priests, lived in this area because they worked on the Temple Mount, right? And they produced the Ketoret, the incense for the temple, hence the name Katros. Do you understand this? This was a family that lived here over 2,000 years ago. This family produced the incense for the temple. And they think that probably what happened was that the Roman legionnaires burst in during the end, right, and caught them during dinner. Okay? And they know that there were at least five people living in this house. They know one of them was a teenage girl because they found the phone bill. No, I'm just kidding. But the big question here is, who were these people? And where'd they go? And what happened to them? Were they led off into slavery, like 120,000 of their brothers and sisters, in that month of August of the year 70 alone? Were they separated? You know? And you try to imagine the Holocaust, what little we know of it, the pictures that come to mind, and then step it back 2,000 years. If you were standing on this street corner on a particular July evening in the year 70, you would have heard the sound of thunder. It was the thunderous sound of the battering rams that were breaching the wall nonstop 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then one day, you know, it's easy to notice sound that starts. You don't always right away notice sound that stops, right? One day you would notice that the sound stopped. And you wouldn't be happy that the sound stopped, because what that would mean is that they had breached the wall. And this no longer became a safe place for students. We're not going to go in there, but I urge you, you're around here, if you find a half an hour or the next time you come back, go down into it's called the Burnt House, it's this museum right here, go down into the Burnt House, ask them, there's like a little slideshow, they can do it in English, and you can sit in the living room of a family that lived here 2,000 years ago, right? But anyway, I just told you that because we're passing. What I really want to show you is over here, come. Oh, Maslomech. If anybody wants a mitzvah to give tzedakah, this is a big mitzvah. You know what? I'll tell you something. When you ask little kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? Nobody says, I want to be a beggar. So it's tough. Nobody wants to sit out in the cold, you know. Nebuch. See what I mean, by the way? See the stuff just sits here? It's unbelievable. Thousands of years old. All right, short people in the front, so I guess if you're sitting, you have to... I want you to know, this synagogue is a synagogue called the Churva Synagogue. It's a long story what the synagogue is and the journey it went through. It's hundreds of years old. And the Arabs destroyed it after 1948 in the War of Independence when we lost the old city. When we came back, they started to rebuild it. They ran out of money. But they succeeded in rebuilding this magnificent arch that was part of the Churva Synagogue. And for years, it became part of the skyline of the old city of Jerusalem. And some people said we should rebuild the synagogue. And some people said, no, we should leave it destroyed so people will remember what happened and whatever. Well, you know how the world really works. Whoever has the bucks wins. So eventually they raised enough money to make them an offer they couldn't refuse. And I hear that side of the coin. I hear both sides. I don't have a strong opinion either way. On the one hand, there is something to be said for the message of such a structure lying in desolation. On the other hand, it's a shul. And it should be rebuilt, and we should have a chance to pray there and to study there. Anyway, they raised the money, they started to rebuild it. So in order to rebuild it, for safety purposes, they had to take the arch down. So all the people in the old city are like all upset about the arch, but all right. And you're witnessing a fulfillment of a prophecy. right? That the day will come, right? That the city of Yerushalayim will yet fill. That the sounds of building will return, right? Etc. Right? What's amazing about this building is that when they started to build, they realized they had to check out the foundations for safety. I mean, it's been sitting desolate for like 40 years, so they had to dig underneath and open up and check the foundations, make sure they were safe. When they did this, of course, they found an entire neighborhood of Kohanim, houses, including two mikvahs, and now I just heard from Barnea Sullivan that they might have found a third, right? Because this was, you know, I mean, a mikvah is basically to purify yourself. This is like super mikvah land. You know, everybody who wants to work and go up on the Temple Mount, I mean, they got to get serious, right? So they had to redo the plans for this whole shul because it's sitting on top of a 2,500-year-old neighborhood. And that's why it's taking them four times as long. By the way, it's a great way to up your bill, but that's a separate story. They've actually closed off the edge. It used to be that you could sneak a peek and see the ruins underneath what they're building. I don't know if you can. We'll take a look, right? But that isn't actually why I stopped you here, right? Stopped you here because of this, okay? See this over here, all right? So most people, they walk by this, and it's like annoying. Like, you know, they ran out of money. They couldn't finish the sidewalk, right? It looks like, right? What are these stones, okay? So towards the end of the period of the Second Temple, right, there was a king by the name of Agrippas. Now, by this time, Rome was the big bully on the block, and they were in control, okay? And Judea, this area, was really a vassal state of Rome. And there was a king, his name was Agrippas, and he had a problem, like all politicians have a problem, unemployment. So he came up with a great solution. Create a public works program, right? And give the people what to do. So he decided to refortify the walls of Jerusalem. So he quarried stone, people were working, great. The only problem was, while he was doing this, that Rome got wind of the fact that he was refortifying the walls of Jerusalem. This did not make them happy, okay? They didn't want the Jews refortifying the walls for obvious reasons. So they sent a letter to Agrippus that basically went something like, I don't know, Dear Grip, we'd really like you to stop refortifying the walls or we're going to come crush you, right? So Agrippus was a smart fellow, he stopped. But he had all these stones fortified, right? So what do you do with them? So he decided to make them into a sidewalk for all the Kohanim. All the priests, they have to get to the Temple Mount, now they'll have their own sidewalk. I want you to understand what that means. That means, shalom, that means that every Kohen, right? Maslomchem,
what is
your
name?
What is my name? My name is Fulbini, what is your name?
My name is Lidor. My name is Lidor.
Ken? Lidor? And where are you from? Kiryat Gat. Do you know who is from Kiryat Gat? אתם יודעים מי מקיריית גת? במקור, מי היה מגת, אתם יודעים?
כן,
הפלישתים. יפה. Do you guys know who's from Gat? They come from Kiryat Gat. Do you know who's from Gat? So he said right away, the Philistines, the Plishtim. This kid knows more Tanakh, more Bible, than all of you put together, right? I want you to understand that's the greatness of the state of Israel, in a nutshell. I paid him $50 to walk over, right?
הם מדברים
אנגלית. אתה יודע אנגלית? כן? יפה. So I want to tell you it is very good to meet you, and חזק וברוך, and you should be strong, and you should be safe and in peace. I get two from you, okay. Okay. הם מדרום אפריקה, from South Africa. אני ישראלי, בדם. אפרת. אוקיי, אז תנו לי רק, אני אגמור סיפור, בסדר? חזק, חזק, וברוך, כל הכבוד. שלום. It just doesn't get better than that. Spent all morning planning that. Anyway, so, I love that. I love that the little kid with the spiked haircut, he knows Tanakh, he can tell you where Goliath came from. That's unbelievable. But anyway, right? So, any Kohen, any priest that lived at the end of the Second Temple period, he had to walk on these stones. I remember I once brought a group of Israelite students in the summer, and we were studying the Mishnah of Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol, the high priest at the end of the temple. It's a very powerful Mishnah. So instead of studying it up there, we came down here, and we sat on these stones, and we learned the Mishnah. I said to them, you know, he walked here. He didn't walk somewhere. He walked here. Rabbi Akiva, when he came to visit here after the destruction, he had to walk on the sidewalk. He came across here, you know? And the Kohanim in the time of the temple walked here, right? So some places like this, you know, you kind of walk around because like it's bumpy. But you got to walk on these stones because you got to feel where you're walking. But I really showed you this so I could show you something over here. Come. You see this mailbox?
British
mailbox, right? Feel the sucker. Feel it. Feel this mailbox. That is a 2-ton mailbox. 2 tons. Don't you think that's a little excessive for a mailbox? 2 tons? Right? We'll just fill her while you're catching up. It's okay. So I'll tell you why this mailbox is 2 tons. It's because when the British brought these over from England, they built them. During the period of the British Mandate, there were a lot of people trying to get the British out. Arabs, Jews, whoever. And one of the unfortunate methods that was employed were letter bombs. Okay? So they built these mailboxes. You can't fit even a tape cassette in here. It's so narrow that you can't fit anything but a narrow envelope, and that's why it's reinforced. Now, on the one hand, it makes me very sad that we still need these mailboxes. On the other hand, I love the fact that Israelis get their Israeli army mail through a British mandate mailbox. Do you understand this? Right? I mean, that is just Jewish history in a nutshell. But come over here. Okay, we're going to walk through the tunnel. It's tremendous, huh? So, this is one of those places that people walk by all the time, okay? And you can ask people about it once you know what it is, and they won't even know where it is, right? Yeah, help yourself, grab a seat, you know? Give you a little background, okay? In 1917, the British came to this part of the world, right? And I told you this morning, they were given a mandate to try to figure out what to do. They gave it back to the League of Nations. The League of Nations, the United Nations decided to create 2 states. The Jews were excited, the Arabs were not. Hence, the War of Independence was born. Okay? Now, the Arab armies could not attack because they didn't want to invade British sovereign territory until the British left. But the Arabs in the country had no such compunctions. And the best example of that was the Jordanian Legion. The Jordanian Legion was absolutely the best fighting force in the Middle East. They were British trained, they were French armed. They are the only Arab force that we consistently lost to in the War of Independence. We lost the Old City to them. We lost Hebron. We lost Gush Etzion. Huge areas, okay? Very rare that we won a battle against the Jordanian Legion. There were 200 fighters from the Palmach, the early vestiges of the IDF. They were defending 1,400 civilians here inside the Jewish quarter. Men, women, the old, the young, children. They were surrounded, these 200 fighters protecting 1,400 civilians, by 3,200 Jordanian legionnaires. In addition to the Jordanian legionnaires, now 3,000 guys in those days, that's about 4 full brigades. Okay? Talking about 1 battalion, not even in full strength, trying to hold off 4 brigades. That's crazy. In addition to the 3,200 Jordanian legionnaires, there were about 30,000 Arab irregulars. Now, what's an Arab irregular? You go into an Arab village, maybe like the one we saw yesterday. They say, Allah min al-Yahud, you know, let's go kill some Jews. Whoever has a hunting rifle comes out. Presto, you have an army. Now, on the one hand, this is a mob. And fighting against a mob has its advantages. We've learned this, unfortunately. Losing to a mob is a very frightening proposition. Okay? So, you have to understand the numbers here. We're talking 33,000 Arabs. Surrounding 200 fighters, not protecting 1,400 civilians. That's not just crazy, that's psychotic. Somehow they hold out for 6 months. In the last 6 weeks, when the fighting starts to really get intense, okay, we have this image that the Jews are like behind the old city walls and they're firing from behind the walls. That's not the way it was. I mean, you saw this morning, there's a Muslim quarter, the Jewish quarter. The reason that we stopped here was because the Jews had 3 heavy machine guns amongst them. That's all they had. And one of them sat here. This was a machine gun position. And basically the reason it was here was because this is the widest avenue of approach from the Muslim quarter into the Jewish quarter. And they attacked here pretty much once, twice a day in battalion strength, the Jordanian Legion. And therefore it was critical that there be a machine gun post here to try to hold them off. These 3, and it didn't look like it is today, you know, it wasn't like marble paved and, you know, that was more like dirt, it wasn't like nice steps, right? And there were sandbags. Now these 3 guys who were manning this machine gun position could not leave under any circumstances. Because if one guy isn't here and the gun jams, and you only have one guy with his machine gun firing in the meantime, that could be all the difference between the fall of the Jewish quarter and the loss of Jerusalem. So there was a rule that these three guys, they had to stick here no matter what. They couldn't leave for anything. Not to eat, not to go to the facilities. Every day a runner would bring them lunch, right? And that's how they would eat. And then they would, until they were switched by the next three guys. So one day these three guys are sitting here. And lunch doesn't come. 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, they start to get nervous. Maybe the Jordanians have somehow routed them from behind. Maybe they're surrounded. You know, who knows what's going on? This was a very dynamic battlefield. So finally one of them goes out to check. And eventually finds what happened to his lunch. Okay, the runner, who was the youngest Israeli soldier ever to be killed in active combat duty, his name was Nissim Gini. He was
10.
Okay. He was 10 years old. And he was killed not far from here. He was shot in the stomach. And one of the questions that they had afterwards was why he didn't call out. Somebody would have heard him, right? Stomach wounds is an incredibly painful way to die, right? The theory, which of course we'll never know, is that maybe he didn't want to call out because he understood he was hit by a sniper. Sniper fire is a very surreal type of warfare because, you know, in the movies you always know there's a sniper, right? Because there's music. So you always know there's a sniper. But in real life there's no music. You don't know there's a sniper. And he was afraid that whoever was, you know, would come to help him would be hit by the same sniper. So he prefers this 10-year-old boy to die in silence rather than to risk the lives of his comrades. Now, in 1967, in the Six-Day War, when Israel came back to Jerusalem and discovered sort of everything destroyed and whatever else they discovered, they decided that they wanted to build a memorial to those who fell during that siege, civilians and soldiers. So they thought that this, therefore, would be an appropriate place to do it. This was actually originally like a sort of utilities room that was attached on to the Churva Synagogue. You can see that it's Ottoman period architecture. It's about 450 years old, right? So they decided to sort of spread it out a little. They dug in a little. They built some nice steps. They built a marble floor. In the process of fixing up this room, they discovered this. Okay? There's a reason this isn't sort of whitewashed and paved over. This is a Crusader arch. It is the largest Crusader arch in the entire Middle East. Look at the size of this baby. When you go to Crusader period structures, you will normally see that the size of the arch, the depth, goes to like here or here. This is huge. The theory is, they know from writings that there was a huge church in this area the Crusaders built, right? And this fits date-wise. So they think that this is one of the arches that held up that church. They became excited about this and they started to dig in. Okay? And that's how they found the rest of this arch. But the real reason they discovered this arch was so that they could discover this. Because this hole over here is a mikveh. And this mikveh, this ritual bath, dates back 2,000 years to the period of the end of the Second Temple. And this makes a lot of sense. Because who needs a mikveh in the old city of Jerusalem more than anybody else? The Kohanim, the priests. Why did Agrippus, that king, build the Kohanim their own separate sidewalk? Because they need to be ritually pure. Right? When they go up on the Temple Mount. How do you get ritually pure? You immerse yourself in a mikveh. You get out of the mikveh, the ritual bath, and you want to go to the Temple Mount, and then some schnook doesn't notice and he bangs into you. You got to go to mikveh again. So this way they had their own sidewalk. This makes a lot of sense. They would go to mikveh, jump up on the sidewalk, and walk up to the Temple Mount. And by the way, what is a mikveh? What is that whole thing? What does it mean that you're impure, you're tamei, you're impure, you're unclean, you're dirty, whatever translations you can find? And then you jump in the water. What is that about? You know, a woman has her menstrual cycle. She's uncle. What does that mean? So the truth is that tum'ah, what we call impurity, really means contact with death. Okay? Any type of impurity is always about contact with death. You touch a dead animal. You come into contact with a dead body. The menstrual cycle is the loss of potential life, the breakdown of the uterine wall, right? A man's seminal emission is the loss of potential life. All these things are impurity. And that's because they're two parts to who we are. There's the physical side of who we are, you know, but that's not all that we are. And then there's the spiritual side, the soul. And we live with this tension. Are we just animals? Are we just physical beings? Are we here today and gone tomorrow? Because if that's the case, then what's the point? Then just have a good time, right? Or are we something more? Do we have the capacity to go beyond our physical instincts, the ability to love and to give and to care and to make a contact with and connect to something much greater than the physical limitations, whatever you want to call that, God or otherwise, right? And this tension is a constant tension in life. What is the ultimate reminder that at the end of the day we're physical beings? That's death. Because it's over. Judaism believes it's not over. So I have to deal with that contact. I have to struggle with that contact. You know, in Judaism, when someone dies, you don't just go back to work. You sit shiva for 7 days. And so when you come into contact with death, you're unclean, you're struggling with this issue for 7 days. And what's the final process of our reaction to our dealing with death? We immerse ourselves in water, because water represents life. Judaism believes that ultimately you have to be willing to re-immerse yourself in life. By the way, that is the story of the State of Israel. 3 years after the Holocaust, the ultimate contact with death, the Jewish people are reborn. And they recreate themselves. It's amazing. Do you understand this? We're sitting in a place where Jews were willing to die. They were willing to give up everything for something that they felt was greater than life itself. And they were doing it in the exact spot where 2,000 years earlier, Kohanim priests were immersing themselves in life because they felt that that was even greater than death. Do you understand that? That is Jewish history in a nutshell. It's just a circle. And we're part of the same experience. So you get that, right? So anyway, I showed you this so I could show you something else, but you can't miss this. If you want, you can take a look. They put the names, the light bulb went out, but they put the names of those who fell in the mikveh. There's a list here. You can ignore this map. It's upside down. It's another story. And come outside. We'll meet outside. Come. We good? Follow me. Okay, you know what? You go right here, and you guys stand over here along the steps. Can you stop? There we go. All right? I just want you to take in this image, okay? We're not going to walk down here because there's so much to see. We only have so much time, and I'm going to tell you about this so that you can walk down it on your own later. What you're looking at, okay, is an ancient Roman sidewalk, okay? This sidewalk, right, is 1,800 years old. And there's one detail about this sidewalk, okay, that changed the way I looked at this forever. All right? We're going to do something a little different. Instead of walking through here, we're going to walk above them and show you it from above so that you can join us. But this is the easiest place in the world. You will not find anyone who has ever visited the Jewish quarter who doesn't visit this sidewalk. But most of them don't know the following detail. All right? In the year 70, there were 220,000 Jews crammed into living in the old city of Jerusalem. There was no Jewish quarter. It was a Jewish city. Okay, there were no Muslims yet. Islam was born in the 7th century. Okay, this was a Jewish city. All right? Just so you understand, today, the Jewish population of the old city is 10%. There are about, give or take, 60,000 people in the old city of Jerusalem. Okay? 6,000 of them are Jewish. All right? And about 90% are Arab. Muslim, Christian, Armenians that aren't Arabs, but whatever. Right? In the year 70, when the temple was destroyed, you know, people don't appreciate this. There is a fast day called the 9th of Av. You ever heard of Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av? Does anybody know what happened on Tisha B'Av? Do you know what happened on Tisha B'Av? Pardon? That's right, the temple was destroyed. Okay, we're talking about the second now, the year 70, right? Temple was destroyed. All right? 3 weeks before that, on the 17th day of Tammuz, which is always a fast day, right? The Romans breached the walls, what I was talking about earlier. The battering ram stopped, and the hordes poured into the old city, okay? There were three full legions, 15,000 trained barbarians. You have to understand who the Roman soldiers were. They used to put the heads of their enemies onto the edges of their spears. And, pardon? And carry all these trophies that I'll spare you in case you want to eat lunch later around with them, okay? There's always one thing that bothered me, and these are called the 3 weeks of mourning. From the time they breached the walls on the 17th of Tammuz, which is usually in July, until the 9th of Av, which is usually in August when they destroyed the temple. And this is a very intense period around here. People stop shaving, they stop public music, you know, no weddings, all this sort of stuff. And the question is, why did it take them 3 weeks? I mean, you've walked from the old city walls to the Kotel, to the Temple Mount. How long does it take to get from the Kotel walls to the Temple Mount? 10 minutes. 20 minutes. If you're listening to Rabbi Aaron, 30 minutes. You know, whatever it might be, right? If you're lucky enough to have your granddaughters pushing you, 60 minutes. 3 weeks. What takes 3 weeks? So the question is, how do you keep tens of thousands of Roman legionnaires sitting outside the old city wall for 2.5 years of siege? in the bitter, bitter cold of winter, it's freezing here at night, in the heat of the summer days, underneath the blistering sun, you basically promise them everything they want when they get in. The reason it took them 3 weeks was because they raped, pillaged, burned, and looted their way through the old city of Jerusalem. According to Josephus, they killed 100,000 in less than a month. 100,000 Jews in a month. This was before gas chambers, before anything. Now, the Jewish community did not disappear. There was a very strong Jewish community here, but now they were living under the heel of Rome. Some 60-odd years later, they decided that it was enough. They couldn't handle the heel of Roman oppression, so they revolted again. This time under the auspices of a fellow by the name of Shimon Bar Koziva, Shimon Bar Kochba. Okay? Bar Kochba, Rabbi Akiva, believed that he was going to be the Messiah, he would be the charismatic leader that would restore royalty and build the temple. It proved to be a big mistake, it was a disaster. Over the next 4 years, Hadrian, the emperor of Rome, put down with brutal precision this Jewish revolt. And it makes sense, by the way. When the first temple was destroyed, 70 years later, they built a second temple. So they figured it was 60-some-odd years since the second temple was destroyed. Time for a third one. This would not be quite so simple. In those 4 years, according to some historians, they murdered as many as 2 million Jews. Do you understand this? 2 million Jews. This is before machine guns, before carbon monoxide vans. They did it with their hands. And when they were finished, Hadrian decided enough was enough. Two revolts in less than 70 years, they couldn't handle that. Right? So he decided to put an end to what he perceived to be the spirit of Jewish independence. Jews went underground. In fact, Jews began to live in caves. It was so prevalent to live in caves, they've discovered over 5,000 caves in the Elah Beit Shibrin Valley alone where Jews lived. It became forbidden in the Talmud to wear hobnail boots, Nalai Masumarot, according to Tosfot, because if you walked over a cave, it would sound like you were Roman legionnaire. Jews might panic on Shabbat. In other words, it was so prevalent for Jews to live in caves in fear that it reflected itself in Jewish tradition. As part of this destruction, Hadrian burnt what was left of Jerusalem to the ground. He pounded into rubble. And he rebuilt it as a Roman city called Aulina Capitolina. It became forbidden to say the name Jerusalem on pain of death. Okay? And that street was built by Jewish slaves. But here's the catch. And when I found this out, it changed the way I looked at this street. Jewish slaves built this street. It's called the Cardo. It's basically down the heart, cardiovascular, the heart of Jerusalem, right? They built this street, but they weren't allowed to walk there. If you as a Jew were caught, by the way, until almost the birth of Islam, for 600 years, 500 years, if you were caught in the Roman Catholic Empire, walking on this street or in the old city of Jerusalem, you were put to death on the spot. There's a place further down the street where they actually did it. And here we stand in a modern state of Israel, and where is Rome? And I'll give you the best example I can think of. You see those rocks on top of the pillars? Right? You see those pebbles? What ancient ritual? What does that? Do you know? Does anybody know what that is? Does anybody know what that is? No, no. Good guess though. When someone dies, you put a stone. No. I used to walk by these pillars. I could never figure this out. It used to drive me nuts. What other stones doing there? Until one day, I'm walking here at the end of the day in the summer, and there's a group of Jewish kids, and they're sitting on the edge here, okay? And they've got pebbles, and they're playing a game. You know? Can you get the pebble on the column? To understand this. Jewish children in the old city of Jerusalem in the modern state of Israel have turned the Roman Empire into their game. Do you understand this? That's Jewish history. We're patient. We'll wait. It's okay. Give it a couple thousand years. Do you understand? It's such a bracha that we live in this time. You know? Come, we're going to walk back this way.
How many people were there in the city in 70? You said
220,000. 120,000 of them were sold into slavery. They flooded the slave market. The slave market went bankrupt overnight. Josephus writes that there were millionaires who went bankrupt overnight because all of a sudden the slaves flooded the market. You know? You don't think about it in economic terms. You know? Come. So imagine that we walk down there. Okay? You can see very clearly the... By the way, I got to tell you something else just before we talk about this. Look up there. This is the Churva Synagogue. Okay? This is the largest shul in the Jewish quarter. Now look up there, and it's destroyed. Like, you can't see it. You can look it up in pictures, right, in photos, but you can't see it. It's a destroyed building that they're rebuilding. Look above this. Your children will not, Bezrat Hashem, God willing, be able to understand what I'm about to share with you, because this image is going to disappear. 6 months from now, you will not be able to see from this place what I'm about to show you. Do you see that crest? Okay, what is that? What is that? You see what I'm talking about? What is that? Top of a mosque. It's actually not the mosque, the minaret of the mosque. Okay? Now, when they came back here, because the Muslims build, we talked about this in East Jerusalem, we talked about it this morning at Herod's palace, right? Every place that there's a holy place of another religion, the Muslims turn into their mosque. Now, you can look at this in two ways. If I was the PR guy for Islam, I would tell you that it's beautiful that we find other people's religions holy as well, and we want to pray there, and that could be. And you can accept that. That really could be. Maybe. Right? Or, you know, sort of the skeptical view, right, is maybe they understood that the places of holiness, the religious places, were how you control. And so they wanted to take over and decimate and wipe out the previous religion. Which, by the way, is my opinion. That's not my opinion of Islam, but that is my opinion of the particular Muslim rulers that did these things, right? So now we came back here in 67. So how come that mosque is still standing? That mosque, no Muslim will go to that mosque. It's in the middle of the Jewish quarter. They closed it. You can't go there. They don't want a mosque in the middle of the Jewish quarter. This is a Jewish quarter. This was never Arab. Okay? So there was a discussion about this. Mota Gur, who was the brigade commander, and eventually Teddy Kalik, who also got involved because they were real building Jerusalem, and they decided, we didn't come back to Yerushalayim to destroy a mosque. That's not what we're about. So they left that mosque there. But I wanted to stop you here, okay? This is the Cardo. You can see very clearly the columns on the side, right, form the colonnade, okay? And basically, this is basically a marketplace. And people would walk down the marketplace, okay, and they would sell stuff here. Now, just out of curiosity, what do you think they sold? Don't answer that question. Look over here. You see this? Okay? This is a menorah, right? There is a group called the Temple Institute that decided that we don't want to wait any longer for the Mashiach to come. We want to start getting ready. It's very complicated what the menorah and the temple is going to look like. They got a group of rabbis, some of the greatest Torah scholars in the world, and they explored all the Talmudic texts, and basically over a period of 2 years, they built a menorah that is exactly according to the specifications of the menorah that will be in the temple. Just as an example, the menorah in the temple has to be mikshay echad zahav. It has to be from one solid block of gold. They had to make a solid block of gold that was big enough from which they could carve the menorah. Okay? In fact, when they tried to insure this, they ran into a problem. How do you come up with the correct price? This is a priceless item. It's a once in a lifetime, one unique item. There's nothing like it in the world. It's priceless. Do you insure something based on sort of the value people place in it, what people would pay for it, which is my potential lost income? You couldn't put a price tag on this. In the end, they decided to insure it for the amount that it cost to build it, plus a percentage. That's what they did.
You know what that was?
Pardon?
You know roughly what that was?
I've heard different figures. One person told me it's insured for $22 million. Another person told me it's insured for $7 million. It's bigger than Israelite's budget. That I can tell you. That's why it's surrounded by this whole security system. Look, by the way, at the top of the menorah. Okay? How is this different from Hanukkah? Hanukkah has 8 candles. This has 7. Okay, a Chanukiah is for Hanukkah, 8, because it was 8 days. The menorah had 7. Now that's a whole discussion about 7s and 8s, but not for now. Why did they put this here? Because they decided to have this and not let people see it as crazy. So if you think about it, now what's really freaky, there's a Zohar, which is a book of Kabbalah, that says the day will come when the Jews will come home, right? And as the menorah accompanied the Jews into exile, the menorah will herald their return. That's what it says. That'll be what brings them back. And so it's interesting.
All year round, the menorah?
menorah set in the temple, right? In the Heichal, in the first of the inner section of the actual building of the temple, and it provided light for no one.
Every day it was lit?
Every day it was lit. Every morning the Kohanim would light it, and it was lit round, and then they would prepare the wicks and light it again in the morning.
And the purpose of it was to give light?
The purpose of it was as a symbol that the Jewish people are about light. That our job is to give light into the world. It wasn't providing light. You didn't need the light of the menorah. In fact, supposedly there's a miracle that the wicks faced inward so they wouldn't give light. But come. I got another story to tell you. Come. Hang on. Stand right here. Hang on. Remember I asked you before what they sold in the Cardo? Eh? Well, what they sold was the loot of the Jewish people. Anybody here ever been to Poland? All right. You go to Poland and you walk by in Warsaw any silver store, and you'll see your grandmother's candlesticks. You'll see menorahs. You'll see yads, like, you know, pointers from Torah scrolls. Unbelievable, the chutzpah that these people have to sell these things. Right? That was this bazaar. And back there, they kept it in its original form so that you'll appreciate the antiquity. Here, they now don't look at the ceiling, because the ceiling here is like Crusader period, but the lower part of the Cardo here, they rebuilt it as it was. So you can go today, and you can buy tefillin, you can buy Shabbos candlesticks, you can buy a talis in a stall that was built by Jewish slaves for the Roman Empire to sell Jewish loot. Right? And where is Rome? You understand this? Pardon? You can buy Roman grass for nothing, right? All over the place. Come, I got one more story here, come. I just want to get a sense. First of all, does anybody need a bathroom here, or you're all good? We're good? Okay. Because the one thing about Yerushalayim, the public bathrooms here are very clean, and there's one around the corner. We could do this two ways. I have an amazing story to tell you. Before I tell you, we could really go for another, I don't know, 45 minutes, if you have the energy for it.
Yeah.
Or we could stop in 15 minutes. You guys up for, like, do you want more? Because sometimes less is more. I don't want to, like, it's cold. You're good for this? It's okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.